This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here through the hour to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, give us a call right now at 1-800-462-7413. Zorba, we always have some useful information along with our calls. What's on the doc?
Well, we don't have any useless information. All our information hopefully is useful. Cloudy days may impair your ability to think. Mm-hmm. Now, that would be useful because some people live in cloudy days, like a lot of the country, some of the time or all of the time.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about soldiers who come back from combat experiences. They don't necessarily just have post-traumatic stress disorder, which is one issue, but it may impair the stress they've seen, may impair their ability to think, to cognate, to think about things and engage in executive function.
Important topic it is. What's our recipe?
Spicy pumpkin soup. Now, I know you're a cynic when it comes to pumpkin, Tom. I know, just looking at you when I said pumpkin soup, you know, you had that face that didn't necessarily smile.
Well, I'm not a cynic. I don't like it.
Well, that's probably because you've never tried pumpkin soup. It is absolutely delicious. And we tend to associate pumpkin only with pumpkin pie. I happen not to like pumpkin pie. Pumpkin soup is completely different. Think of pumpkin as a squash, and you will love this recipe.
We'll see. We have our medical mythbuster coming up later in the hour, so do stay with us for that, too. Here's our number again, 800-462-7413. Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener now in Orchard Park, New York. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
I have a son who has ADHD, and he takes Folclin 10 milligrams in the morning. He also has a lot of allergies, and my question is, if he takes Allegra or any of the other drugs at night, will that interfere in the morning, or is the combination just not a good combination?
At what age was he diagnosed?
6.
And how old is he now?
He's 14.
One of the things I would do, just looking at ADHD, that I think is good, and the nice thing about the web is it democratizes information. I was just discussing this with one of my colleagues last night. One of the things I just recommend, even he has the diagnosis, and I'm going to assume that he has it, go to the diagnosis of ADHD, do DSM, that's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, space ADHD, and just Google that, and you'll end up getting up the diagnostic criteria for ADHD. And look at it, look in your son, and see whether or not it applies to him. Even though he's had that before and he's been on medicines for a long time, I just think it's useful for you to know, yes, indeed, he has this. Part of the diagnosis, by the way, it has to occur before the age of 15. You know, clearly he had that from 6.
Yeah.
Mixing meds, always a good question to ask, and the reason is if you look overall globally at mixing medications, it's responsible for a lot of deaths. The Institute of Medicine thinks it's responsible for up to 100,000 deaths a year, which is a huge amount. That's four to five times as many as prostate cancer and twice as many as we have for automobile deaths, and it's far greater than suicides and murders in this country. So looking at drug interaction is crucial. If we look at antihistamines, they're really safe. They're incredibly safe drugs to give. So you can definitely give an antihistamine. And if you're looking at something such as Allegra, Zyrtec, or loratadine, which is Claritin, they're non-sedating antihistamines. You can give them any time of the day. A better antihistamine, if you're really suffering, is Benadryl, but you give that at nighttime because it makes you sleepy. But I think it'll be fine. Does he have any trouble sleeping on his meds?
No, he takes the Folclin one time a day. He takes it in the morning.
How does he like that? I mean, because that's the new kid on the block when it comes to ADHD.
You know, he has a headache.
Mm-hmm.
And once he was diagnosed, I looked through all the natural remedies probably in the world I've ever thought about. And I really couldn't come up with anything that primarily helped him focus. That's his biggest concern. But with this, he takes the medication, he will even request it from me to help him, you know, focus and learn in school. When he comes home, his head always hurts constantly.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, you've obviously tried different medications for him. Dose adjustments sometimes down can get rid of the headaches. Sometimes it won't. Or, more importantly, he may have migraines. He might just have headaches.
Yeah.
And so a beta blocker such as Atenolol or Inderol might get rid of his headaches. So I would look and I would go to the doctor and say, hey, what about either adjusting it down? Let's see if that works and he can still concentrate, which is a big issue. And by the way, one of the ways to tell if the drugs really work is little kids don't like drugs.
Yeah.
And if they take it and it helps them concentrate, they like it. They don't take it for secondary gain. But I'd look at adjustment down of the medicine or I'd look at a concurrent diagnosis such as migraines, which are not uncommon. So good luck with him. You do a great job.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for the call at 1-800-462-7413. A listener now, Zorba, in Detroit, Michigan. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, what's up?
Well, I have a question regarding artificial sweeteners. I don't like to add sugar or wash my teeth in sugar, meaning I don't drink pop that has, you know, straight sugar, and I don't drink coffee with sugar.
Mm-hmm.
Which of the artificial sweeteners is the best, or would the better choice of artificial or non-artificial, meaning sugar, would sugar be the better choice?
Now, you're taught, just to go back for a second, you don't brush your teeth with sugar, of course, which, which makes a lot of sense. Because if you brush your teeth with sugar, that would not be an intelligent choice. It would not be the right thing to do. When you're looking at sweeteners, what are you looking for use for? You know?
Well, I want to put something sweet in my coffee, and I would like to have an option of Diet Coke or something like that to drink.
Okay,
you know,
so you're looking, so let's look at sweeteners kind of overall. First of all, aspartame, which is NutraSweet, aspartame are actually two amino acids. It's a protein. It's a protein. It does not break down into formaldehyde. I mean, all that stuff is universally junk that's on the web. It's absolute junk science. Formaldehyde is not what you're getting when you're getting NutraSweet. When you're getting NutraSweet, you're getting two amino acids, protein, in your body that happens to taste sweet. So let's go to the next thing. Splenda. Well, Splenda comes from sugar. It's derived from sugar. It's thought to be safer. Is it safer? Well, it's probably in the same realm as NutraSweet, but it can be used in baked goods, and NutraSweet could not because it breaks down. It's no longer sweet. The amino acid is there, but doesn't have any taste to it at all. So enter that. And now we have the new kid on the block, stevia. So stevia comes from a plant, so it's more natural. Well, there's some good thought to that. There's nothing engineered about it. It's natural. It's from a plant. So it's as natural as it is sugar. There's nothing, you know, there's manufacturing in the process to essentially refine it, but it's just like beet sugar or cane sugar or any other kind of sugar. So if I were to choose among all of them, I think I'd choose the stevia because it's not manufactured, but I think the others are safe.
If it's like sugar, then why isn't it as bad for you as sugar is?
Well, first of all, sugar has been shown to cause cavities, number one,
Now,
because people without sugar in their cultures, they don't lose their teeth as much. We lose it because of that. And number two, sugar has calories.
And stevia doesn't.
Well, stevia has almost no calories. In other words, it's highly sweet. So of all those, I think the stevia is the safest. My best friend Dan has been using stevia for years, and for years he had to go and get it from underground natural food outlets, and now that it's become mainstream.
Smuggled
I think he's
in
up,
from Mexico.
Absolutely. And I think now that it's mainstream, he's upset because everyone is going stevia, and he said, stevia, I can't believe I was first in this. I could have made gazillions of dollars on stevia and never did that. But getting back now to the soft drinks, the reality is I now am of the belief that people who drink sweet soft drinks don't lose weight because their body then craves the calories. And when you're supposedly satisfied by the sweet soft drink, later on you end up eating just as much food to satisfy your body because your body thinks it's looking for the calories somewhere else. So I don't think you should eat sweet soft drinks. I think from a soft drink point of view, it should be something such as club soda with some lemon or lime or, you know, half orange juice, something like that, and half club soda. But I don't think we should eat these very sweet drinks. I think they add to the obesity.
Well, you know, I wasn't so much looking because of the obesity. I have really great teeth, and I'd like to keep it that way.
Stevia is just off. Stevia, NutraSweet, Splenda, none of them will cause tooth decay.
That's great news, because I just, the idea of drinking a soft drink that had all that sugar. It was like using mouthwash with sugar.
And absolutely.
It just nauseated me
absolutely.
To even think about it.
Right.
I really appreciate the information. It's very helpful.
Yeah, before
Thank you so
before
much.
You leave us, let's see that smile.
Okay.
All right.
I have a face for radio.
Thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
And yes.
She has a face for radio. I love it.
Well, from sugar to sunshine we go now, Zorba. You say you have some information on people who think better on sunny days than they do on cloudy days.
Well, it's very interesting. The issue with clouds is seasonal affective disorder. Now, if we look at what it is, seasonal affective disorder starts at the beginning, really, in the middle of September, the beginning of fall, and mm-hmm. it sort of ends at the beginning of springtime. It's a separate issue. Some people get depressed. A lot of people feel sort of down and out, and they lose some energy. But this is a different issue. What about on just cloudy days, which is sort of unusual? So they looked at people, and they were looking at people and doing what's called a mini mental status exam, which included a number of other things. These were people who are having a variety of physical and psychological tests. And they were looking at people who were actually involved in a stroke study. Looking, you haven't had stroke. Mm-hmm. If you're going to get stroke, can we predict it? And part of it is looking at their ability to handle mental things and to remember things. So within the interviewer said, I want you to remember three things. Table, apple, penny. Now, can you repeat that, Tom?
Well, of course. Table, apple, penny.
That's right. And then later on in the interview, maybe 10 minutes later, they'd say other things. By the end of the interview, somewhere in there, they say, what are the three words?
And chair, orange, and nickel.
And what they found was that some people remember all three words. Some remember two. Some remember one. Then they went back. They were looking for other things within this. They went back and they said, I wonder if this relates to the day of the week, the time of the day we did the interview, and other situations. Mm-hmm. And then they look back at the weather forecast and what occurred. And lo and behold, when the days were cloudy, people were less likely to remember table, apple, and penny.
Isn't that interesting?
Than when the days were not cloudy. Yeah. Now, this was more likely to occur in people who are depressed. Maybe mm-hmm. they weren't concentrating as much. But the numbers seem to also show it in people who weren't depressed.
Yeah.
And it brings up a fascinating concept that maybe when the days are cloudy, we're just not as up to our game because the weather actually affects us.
That's my excuse. We have cloudy weather whenever we do the show.
Table, apple, penny.
What is that number? I wish I could remember. 800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. Here's a listener with us now, Zorba, in Gainesville, Florida. Hi.
Hello, gentlemen.
How can we help?
I just wanted to tell you both, you have a very informative show, and I had a question about alopecia.
Mm-hmm.
I was diagnosed with it about 6 months ago. If you're not familiar with it, it's patchy hair loss.
Mm-hmm. So what's your question for Zorba?
Well, my question is, from what I've read on the internet and from what I've seen, they says it, that the only thing that they can think of that it's caused by is stress. And I'm not a stressed out person. I wasn't stressed until my hair started falling out. But now I'm really stressed.
Yeah.
There is signs of it coming back. I've been told that it'll come back white. I've been told that 90% of the people it comes back, it usually only lasts about 6 or 8 months. But mine, I've only had like one spot that's come back, and I was just curious on what y'all could tell me about it.
Well, I have to bring up the stress issue. It's very funny. My oldest son, Zach, has some alopecia with his facial hair. He has a goatee-type beard.
It's on my face, too.
So facial hair. And he went to a dermatologist. He was living in North Carolina, and they said, well, stress. Well, my son, Zach, doesn't have stress. It doesn't exist in his body. So they say, I'm stressed, and he said, I'm stressed over the loss of this facial hair. Mm-hmm. He said the same thing. And so I look back in the literature to say, well, where does stress fit in? And you know what? There are no good controlled studies of any sort looking at people to say that stress is really an issue. Not at all. Now, we know that people can lose hair under stressful situations. For whatever reason, hair within the body can just stop growing under stress. But from alopecia, which can be blotchy hair loss that's around the body, I don't think there's any evidence of stress. I think it's an old doctor's tale. I think it's a myth that has not been proven and that is passed down from dermatologist to family doctor to internal medicine doc to dermatologist. The reality is we don't know what causes it. We have not the foggiest idea what causes alopecia. And to tell people, hey, you're stressed out, that's why you're losing your hair. You know what? You'd go to New York City and none of the guys in New York City would have any hair. They'd all have alopecia, right?
Right. That's right.
They live in a stressful environment. Or guys, young guys would come back from Iraq or Afghanistan and they'd have patchy hair loss. Talk about stress.
Yeah.
War is stress.
Right.
Are they losing their hair? No. They're not losing their hair. So there's no evidence.
And
I think
he's in Gainesville, Florida. There's no stress.
We know that everyone in Gainesville is unstressed because life is good in Florida, free and easy and breezy. So, A, we don't know what causes it. B, it tends to come back, and sometimes it comes back with color or without color. The observation is that sometimes people then lose the color of that hair. Sometimes injectable steroids into the spot of the alopecia will actually do that. Have they recommended that at all to you?
Yeah, that's my next step. They have a topical cream that I'm using now, and the next step is injection.
Yeah, the topical cream I don't think does anything. I think it's worthwhile trying, but I don't think the evidence is there. The injected steroids, small amounts, numerously given, there's some evidence that that does work. So.
And that's like I said, I really wasn't being funny, but it is kind of funny. I don't have any stress until this started happening, and of course, I stress about it every day. Let me
ease that stress a little bit. Take it from Zorba and from me. There is life after hair loss.
Yes, that's right.
Well, it wouldn't be so bad, you know. And everybody tells me, why don't you just shave it? Well, I do keep it shaved, but obviously, you can still tell the spots. I mean, it'd be different if it would just all fall out, but. You know, the spots is what kills me.
That's it, exactly.
But well, I appreciate your show, and I appreciate your opinions and your information.
Yeah, we appreciate your call. Thank you very much. And Zorba, before the break, let's take a quick question from the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox. This one comes to us from Abby in Wichita, Kansas. She writes, I am a 28-year-old, and I try to work out about 4 or 5 times a week. I usually spend 40 minutes on the elliptical machine. About 20 minutes into my workout, my toes begin to numb. Then I feel pressure and numbness from my arch to my toes for the rest of my workout. It's not necessarily painful, but very uncomfortable. I've tried new shoes and extra stretching, but nothing seems to work. Any suggestions?
Well, yes. I mean, the answer is it's the elliptical, and that's what it is. It's pressure on the superficial nerves around the toes and around the feet. And when you put pressure on that for a period of time, they kind of fall asleep. They don't fall asleep, but they become numb.
Yeah.
And it's from that pressure. So the answer is to do the elliptical. And if it happens at 20 minutes, you do the elliptical for 18 minutes and you head off on the bike. And you go to the exercise bike, and then you go back to the elliptical, if you can, later on. But you got to get those nerves some time. You tried the shoes. Excellent idea, because if there's pressure, it could be from the shoes. But it can be just pressure from the pushing on the elliptical. And frankly, you can do it. You're not doing yourself any harm, but you should probably go to a different machine that would be better for your workout and your brain.
Don't let your lifestyle question go numb. Get it to the show by sending an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have our recipe coming up. You'll want to be listening for that. More of your questions, too, at 800-462-7413. And our medical myth buster, all here on Zorba Pastor and Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. We have callers waiting, but an open line now for you at 1-800-462-7413. Back to the calls after Zorba, our recipe, which is a soup, a spicy pumpkin soup.
Yeah, so I want to talk a bit about pumpkin. Now, do you like pumpkin pie?
I kind of like pumpkin pie.
I don't. I don't like pumpkin pie. I'd love to have a great recipe for pumpkin pie that we could actually do around Thanksgiving. But if we look at pumpkins, it's very interesting. Small green pumpkins can be roasted. We don't use pumpkins like they used in revolutionary times. In Thailand, they use little pumpkins, they steam them, and they put custard inside.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
And pumpkin oil in many parts around the country is actually a delicacy that is often used in potato salad and others, and it's even used in Austria. A few drops of it are put on top of vanilla ice cream, pumpkin oil.
Oh, interesting.
It's got a very robust flavor, robust meaning it's got a very full flavor, so you often mix it with others. But it's interesting. I have never used pumpkin oil in cooking. Yeah. I'm going to use pumpkin oil.
I like pumpkin seeds. Pumpkin seeds are good.
Pumpkin seeds are great. I like pumpkin seeds, yeah. Spicy pumpkin soup.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay. 1 tablespoon of olive oil.
A big tea olive oil.
1 large carrot, chopped.
A large carrot, chopped.
1 large onion, chopped.
A large onion, chopped.
Okay, now 10 cups of broth. Now, I use low-sodium chicken broth, and there was an interesting article in Cook's Illustrated that talked about the fact that low-sodium chicken broth often has more flavor than regular chicken broth because they don't use the same concentration of chicken juice. They basically have to put more chickeny stuff in a low-sodium broth because the salt won't make it taste as good. So low-sodium chicken broth is good if you like chicken. If not, use a veggie broth.
Boy, have you had low-sodium chicken broth?
Well, you may have to add sodium to the taste.
Because there have been periods where you aren't allowed to eat anything because you have some medical thing, but you can eat broth and low-sodium broth, either chicken or it's awful.
Yeah. Well, A, you're sick, right? I mean, nobody eats broth unless they're sick. And B, you're using this in cooking. You're adding pumpkin to it.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a different thing.
It's different
thing
than just eating.
Well, but it's like tofu, Tom. I know that you're anti-tofu, but who eats tofu like custard out of a container? I mean, only the vegan addict would eat it like custard out of a container. It's awful. You've got to put something in it.
Okay.
All right, 10 cups of broth, veggie or chicken.
Yeah.
Okay, 1 cup of lentils.
A cup of lentils.
Are you interested yet?
Yeah.
See, lentils. Yeah. Okay. Teaspoon of ground cinnamon.
Little tea ground cinnamon.
1/4 teaspoon ground ginger.
1/4 little tea ground ginger.
Fresh ginger would be okay there. 1/2 teaspoon curry powder.
1/2 little tea curry powder.
I noticed that you're smiling a little bit.
I like curry.
See, because you like her. 1/4 teaspoon chili powder.
1/4 little tea chili powder.
And 6 cups of pumpkin. Now, if you want to do it the organic way, you buy a pumpkin when it's in season, you scoop it out, and you basically steam it and seed it and cube it.
Yeah.
I did that once in my life. I did it once in my life. And you know what? I won't ever do that again. It's just too much work. I buy the cans.
You don't get the pumpkin pie pumpkin.
Oh, I can't believe it. I didn't even prompt you for that. You've got to read the can.
Yeah. Yeah.
If the can should say pumpkin, done, because some of the pumpkin says for pumpkin pie and it has sugar in it, not done.
Right.
So it has to say pumpkin, 100% pumpkin.
Yeah.
And by the way, it's cheap. It's very cheap. Mm-hmm. And by the way, pumpkin is very good to give to your dog if your dog is constipated. I know this has nothing to do with it, but I just wanted to give you a little side from a vet point of view. Okay. In a large soup pot, heat the olive oil.
You forgot the minced fresh parsley.
Oh, well, that's for the top. Yeah, I did. In a large soup pot, heat the olive oil and saute the carrots and onions. This is too much fun.
Yeah.
Add the broth and lentils. Bring to a boil over high heat. Reduce heat. Partially cover for 30 to 60 minutes. So you're cooking the lentils. Then stir in the cinnamon, ginger, curry, chili, and the pumpkin. Once again, from a can, 6 cups. Or if you're going to do it, you have to make it from the pumpkin itself. Mm-hmm. Return it to a boil. Be careful. You don't want to do it on too hot a heat or it will stick and burn, and then reduce to low, partially cover, and simmer for 1 hour. It's about a half an hour to an hour. Probably doesn't have to be long enough for an hour, but you've got to do it for at least a half an hour or the flavors will not blend. Stir it occasionally so it doesn't get stuck. Salt and pepper to taste. Spoon into the bowls and top with a little fresh parsley. And what's also good on top besides fresh parsley is a plain non-fat yogurt dollop on the top of it with a little parsley on top. And if you want to be really special, get pumpkin oil and drizzle it on top of the pumpkin soup, and it will add that robust smell that the oil has.
Well, this has some spices in, and you put spices in just about anything, and you can get me with it.
A Baba spiced tofu.
Yeah. I'm not ruling it totally out.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. No. We have crossed the Rubicon. We have crossed the Rubicon.
Now, if you'd like this recipe, I suppose you could find it on the web?
Yes, of course. You can find the web at our website, www.zorbapastor.org. You'll find this recipe. You can go and search all of your other favorite Zorba Pastor On Your Health recipes, and you can sign up for our weekly podcast.
The toll-free number if you have a question for Zorba. And Zorba, here's a listener now in Webster Grove, Missouri. Hi.
Hey, Zorba. Hey, Tom. How are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
My question is about raw milk. Mm-hmm. I am picking up my first gallon of raw milk this week, and I'm wondering if you can tell me some of the differences between raw milk and grocery store milk, and what the benefits and risks are of drinking raw milk.
Well, the risk of raw milk is listeria. That's the risk, and it's a real honest-to-goodness risk. So, first of all, I want to state out in front, I'm against raw milk. I think it's a bad idea, and the reason is you don't know where it's coming from, and you don't know if the cow is safe. And one of the reasons that essentially one of the major public health things that occurred was when we started pasteurizing milk, because before that, milk is a live product. And before that, basically, the bad bugs, TB, there's not a lot of TB around, but when I was a kid, our milk carton would say tuberculin-tested cows, because TB can be spread through milk, and there is TB that affects cows, and listeria. Those are, you know, the major things. You're picking this up from where? Where are you getting the raw milk at?
It's from a farm a few hours away, and mm-hmm. they deliver pre-ordered milk to the city weekly.
Now, let me ask you about the farm. Where did you find them?
They supply meat and dairy to a few of the higher-end restaurants in the area, and they also are at one of the local farmers markets every week, and they've been there for a few years.
And do they sell raw milk at the farmers market?
They do only pre-ordered, though.
Only pre-ordered, right, because if they sell it, then the public health people will come and say, you can't do that anymore. I mean, that's basically what it is. On an a lot of state laws on an individual basis like to do it. So let's talk about raw milk. Some people say, well, you'll have good bacteria, amino acids that are not destroyed by pasteurization will be there, and they're more healthful. There's no scientific reason behind that. It's just touchy-feely stuff. It's raw. It sounds good. It sounds organic. We know organic is good. Therefore, raw milk is good. The downside is if the cow is sick, sometimes the farmer knows and sometimes the farmer doesn't know. Give you a very good example in humans. The day you come down with a cold, okay, day one you're sick, is actually when the antibodies in your body are starting to fight the cold germ. On the whole, you're most infectious 2 days, 1 to 2 days before you come down with any symptoms. So in other words, the cow is sick a day or two before the cow has any symptoms. So here it is, Saturday, the cow has been milked. You get the raw milk on Saturday afternoon. Sunday, the cow comes down with symptoms. The cow was sick on Saturday. That's part of the issue. You can't predict the moment the cow is ill or sick. And you can't predict some of these things unless you actually look at the bacterial content of the cow. So, as I said, I'm against it. And periodic, if you go to the CDC, if you Google CDC raw milk, what you'll do is you'll see the outbreaks that occur around the country periodically. There's the CDC comes out with something called morbidity and mortality, and it's a weekly online. It used to be mailed. What's going on in the country? And there's a lot of stuff on raw milk there. Before you drink it, go to cdc.gov and find morbidity and mortality, and look for raw milk, or just Google CDC, morbidity, mortality, raw milk, and look at the outbreaks, then make your decision.
Okay.
Thanks. We appreciate the call.
Thank you so much.
Quick one, Zorba. I assume that farmers, though, drink raw milk.
Well, they drink raw milk in their own farm. Well, they often drink raw milk, but a lot of farmers actually have home pasteurizers, and they pasteurize their milk. Or they'll say, well, I won't give it to my children, but I'll drink it. And so, you know, a lot of them drink raw milk, but a lot of them do not drink raw milk. So once again, the issue is there. But here you have a farm, and they're selling it. You know, they have X number of cows, maybe 50 cows or 100 cows. And at any one time, those cows may be ill. And if it's raw milk, they may not be using antibiotics on their cows. It's a pig in a poke. You get what you're paying for.
Cow milk is a pig in a poke.
I wasn't sure what I was going to come in, you know. It's not a needle in a haystack. Give me a break when I'm coming up with these things. This is radio. This is radio.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. On we go to St. Louis, Missouri now. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, what's up?
Well, in a couple weeks, I'm about to be packing up and going traveling around the country.
Oh.
And I'm on a diet right now of foods that have a low glycemic index, and I was wondering if there were any good snacks for on the road that have a low glycemic index.
Okay, so you're on the road. Are you driving, motorcycling, hitchhiking?
Driving. I have a big van that I'm going to be driving around and living in.
And all on your own?
No, my good friend is going with me.
Ah, and so what's the itinerary?
Well, first leg is the West Coast, and second leg is the East Coast, and then wherever the wind takes us from there.
Oh, are you rich or retired, or both?
Actually, young and poor.
That's right, actually. When I think about when I hitchhiked across Canada, I was young and poor. That's exactly it. I wasn't rich or retired. I was young and poor when I did my road trips. Exactly. Well, basically, most of the snacks you get on the road have high glycemic indexes, right? What do we have? Candy. What do we have? Chips. What do we have? Ice cream. Mm-hmm. So on the whole, the stuff that you get on the road in truck stops is worthless.
Okay.
It's worthless. It's not going to do much. What you have to do is Google it and find some things that you can find in grocery stores and bring them with you. Nuts do not have as high a glycemic index. And that's sort of what you do and you pay attention. But on the road, the things are more expensive in truck stops. You're poor. You're young, you want to save money. And having stuff with you in a little cooler is going to make it more likely that you're going to eat right and not gain weight. I mean, one of the issues is you're in your van or whatever you're traveling with, and if you eat the wrong food, you're going to be heavy by the end of your travels. You don't want that. What are you going to do for exercise when you travel?
Well, I'm bringing a curl bar in the van.
Good.
With me. And also I'm bringing a pair of running shoes, and I go on the treadmill about 3.5 miles a day as is, so I plan on doing a little bit of jogging.
But that's very good. I think jogging, running shoes, a curl bar in the van, these things called TheraBands, which are sort of rubber band things, are very, very good. And stretching exercises, very important, once or twice a day, because otherwise, you know, sitting in a car for long periods of time, you're going to get a little joint stress. So I would do that too. So good luck. I'd recommend going to a grocery store and buying the right stuff and bringing that with you to the van. Stay away from the truck stops.
Okay, thank you very much.
And don't forget, Zorba Pastor on Your Health is on all over the country, so you won't miss a week of our show.
That's right. That's right.
Oh, I won't.
Thanks a lot. We appreciate the call. I mentioned jokingly hitchhiking. Nobody hitchhikes. Nobody picks up hitchhikers anymore.
Well, but I hitchhiked all the time. I remember
You don't hitchhike.
I did. I hitchhiked across the country.
Did. You don't. I mean, not anymore.
Oh, now I don't. I wouldn't.
Nobody.
Hitchhike? Why would I hitchhike? I have an
automobile.
I don't
mean you. I'm saying nobody hitchhikes.
Yeah, nobody hitchhikes. Except in Colorado. When you're going to and from the ski hills, you'll see young men and young women with their skis and with their snowboards putting out their thumb early in the morning hitching. They're often the teachers at the ski hill, but that's about the only place you don't see people hitchhiking anymore. No, days are gone.
Let's check in on the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox now, Zorba, to see if we can help out Anne from Appleton, Wisconsin. Because as she writes, "Dear Dr. Pastor, please tell Big T that this listener is stumped."
You are Big T.
I am not Big T.
Well, you're taller than I am.
I'm tall T, maybe.
Tall T.
Tall
T versus
thin.
Big T.
Tall, thin T.
Tall, thin T. That's right.
Anne explains, "I eat a vegan diet, and my vegan veg life, vitamin D vitamins, are lanolin-free 4,000 IU D2. I believe D3 is derived from sheep lanolin, and there is a concern with sheep contamination. You always make it a point to recommend D3. Is that because the research was done on D3 only? Or is D2 not helpful?"
Well, first of all, I don't think these are derived from sheep at all. I think they're manufactured. Vitamins are manufactured. So, A, it's not derived from sheep. Let's put that. If that were the case, they'd have to put something on there derived from sheep. So I don't know where that information comes from. The research is done on D3, and the reason was D3 is better absorbed than D2. or D4. There are a number of D vitamins. So the research is on D3. That's why I recommend it. Do the other forms of D work? Probably. It's just the research wasn't done on it. On the other hand, maybe they don't. And D3 is the most absorbable of the vitamin congeners. But I don't believe it's derived from sheep. I think it's just a manufactured vitamin. It's synthetic. That's what it is. But it's a vitamin.
Yeah.
So wait, I have a question for you. Is a synthetic vitamin organic? Yes. I mean, it is organic in that the compound is an organic compound.
Yeah.
Vitamins are organic compounds by definition, and vitamin is an organic thing. But if it's synthetically made, it's kind of interesting. It's kind of an oxymoron.
It's really not organic if it's made.
Well, but it is organic. It defines the word organic. It's a vitamin, you see? We need another class. That's what we need, another class. And we need another word for the word police to come back with. Thank you.
We'll hear from listeners on that. If you're stumped too, we want to help. Send us your questions in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
You want to stick around for some interesting research. Some more of your questions coming up at 800-462-7413 and our medical myth buster. Kind of another myth. We just busted one about the sheep thing.
Yeah, we'll keep on busting them all.
Another
along.
Medical
right.
myth buster later here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. In just 3 or 4 minutes or so, we're back to the phones at 1-800-462-7413. But first, Zorba, some really interesting, really important, really kind of serious stuff to talk about
right,
here.
Right. This was an article in the Archives of General Psychiatry, a really important article, looking at soldiers who come back from Iran and Iraq. Mm-hmm. And as I'm sure you've read about, I'm sure others
from
have read about it in the news. I'm sorry.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
But clearly, there's a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder. Yeah. And actually, there was a lot years ago in World War II. It was called shell shock. In Korea, it was called shell shock. And it was called shell shock until it was actually coined as a term in the 70s by a psychiatrist, and it's post-trauma shock, which we know exists, and it's in huge amounts. Mm-hmm. Now, we know that post-traumatic stress disorder can produce, you know, problems socially because soldiers are hypervigilant and they can become anxious. But now they looked at other events that have to do with paying attention and learning. So here you have GIs that are returning. They get the GI Bill. They go to college. And soldiers who have post-traumatic stress disorder are much more likely to have problems concentrating. And the study looked at about 150, 160 men and women 1 year following their return, a group that was all assessed. And the ones who had post-traumatic stress disorder were much more likely to have difficulty doing the schoolwork. They had enhanced reaction time. They were able to jump to attention when things and pay attention to things that might produce a problem, but they had problems concentrating on their work.
Yeah. Now, why is this interesting? Because it's almost a given, isn't it? That one
well,
would go
no,
with the other?
No. The given was you have social issues with PTSD and you have society issues with PTSD. But it was thought that, you know, if a school environment, you're sitting in a classroom, you're there, you're paying attention, it's quiet, there's not necessarily abnormal structure around the outside, or you're home or you're in a library, why would you have difficulty concentrating in the library? In other words, why would you have difficulty making executive decisions? Well, the answer is the PTSD must keep on sort of going in and out of your brain continuously throughout the day.
Isn't that almost the definition of post-traumatic stress?
Well, it's usually the issues are from the outside. So you're going down, you're a soldier who came back from the Middle East, and you're going down a walkway and you're in a grocery store and you turn the corner and you bump into somebody. Yeah. If you have PTSD, you're much more likely to be upset. Or somebody, pushes into you from the back and says, "Pardon me, can you help me?" And you're hypervigilant and you make a response. We're We're not talking about that. We're talking about learning and listening and concentrating. So we know now PTSD not just affects you socially and mentally, but affects your ability to learn and to be able to go to college and ultimately maybe to get a job.
Our toll-free number is 800-462-7413. And Zorba, our next caller is in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help you?
Well, I have sort of an interesting skin issue that I was hoping Zorba could hopefully come up with some answers or ideas. I have been getting a rash that doesn't itch on my forearms and my, like, my hip and side and sort of the back of my knees, and it comes in the morning, and it's gone by the end of the day.
Hmm. And does it happen every day?
Every day for about the past 3 weeks.
Okay, wow. So it comes. How red is the rash?
Well, it's kind of a pink. It almost looks like the size of cigarette burns.
Mm-hmm. Over your entire body, arms, where's the rash located?
It's just on my inner arms, on the forearms.
Uh-huh, inner arms and forearms.
And then it's on my side, like on my hip.
Uh-huh.
Doesn't itch, it's not raised.
Uh-huh. Any change in your health habits at all, using a different soap?
No change in soap. It originally started when I got a cold, and I went to the nurse practitioner, and she said, "Oh, it's just a part of the virus."
Mm-hmm.
But that was about 3, maybe 4 weeks ago. The cold's gone. The rash is not.
Right. Well, a viral rash often will occur when you're sick, and when it disappears, the rash will disappear either. What do you do for a living?
I'm a therapist. I'm a social worker.
Okay, so you're not involved with chemicals. You're not in a factory-type situation where you're involved with things like that. Occurs on the weekend or not?
On the weekend, yes.
Okay, so it's not. I don't think it's a work-related issue, because unless you work on the weekend, it's not a work-related issue. You've stumped me. I have no idea at all what you have. A viral rash is there when the virus is there. It's usually a pinky-type rash, not too prominent, disappears. Of course, you have rashes like measles, mumps, and German measles. We don't see much of that, of course, anymore. I haven't seen it since I was back in medical school or a kid, so we just don't see those things around anymore. And a heat rash will often occur when you're in the middle of a hot situation, physically hot situation. Well, you're working, and then on the weekend there's a different environment for each of those. So I don't have any idea. I don't have any idea what it is. Have you seen a doctor about it? Has anyone looked at the rash?
Only that time that I went.
Only the time that you went and you saw the nurse practitioner.
Yeah, but the interesting thing was, by the time I got to her, it had already faded.
Uh-huh.
So I had taken pictures on my cell phone to be like, I'm not crazy.
Yeah.
This really exists. So no one has really. No doctor has actually seen it.
Yeah, I don't have the foggiest idea of what you have, so I cannot offer you one shred of advice other than the fact that you ought to go in when the rash is there. But it sounds like the rash is so evanescent that by the time you get there, the rash will be gone. Now, you're sure this is not in your brain and you're not making this up?
I was just going to say, you should see a therapist about this.
There you go. That's my advice. Go see a therapist about this rash, because by the time you get there, the rash is gone. I've heard that before. But really, I don't have any idea what you have. Sorry.
That's okay.
Sorry. I don't get stumped very often, but clearly it stumped me.
It stumped me too.
And it stumped other people. Hey, when you find out what it is, if you ever find out, would you please let us know?
Absolutely.
Great.
Thanks.
Sure.
Thanks for the call.
Okay.
800-462-7413. Zorba, time once again for our medical myth buster. We have a listener myth today sent in by Elaine in Spokane, Washington. Today's myth deals with asthma and hearing. Elaine writes, I've heard that people with asthma have more sensitive hearing than non-asthmatics, but I am unable to find any research on this subject. Is this just an urban legend that someone has started?
Well, It probably is an urban legend, but let me tell you where it started because I did some nice research about this. Let me tell you about the article. Here's the article. The acoustic perception of high-pitched tones by patients with bronchial asthma. Okay, so that's the article. Yeah. Let me read you, very simple, let me read you the abstract. A regular and marked increase in hearing acuity at frequencies of 12, 16, and 20 kilohertz. Those are generally low sounds to sort of sounds that we hear with talking. By listening to the ear, air and bone conduction is found in patients with bronchial asthma. Whoa. Study was very good. The study was on 30 patients. Okay, 30 patients. Mm-hmm. The study took place in 1976. Ooh. It took place in Moscow at the Moscow Research in Eye, Ear, Nose and Throat Institute. So let me ask you a question, Tom.
Yeah.
How reliable would be research done in 1976 by the Moscow Ear, Nose and Throat Infirmary that has never been reproduced by anyone else in the last 40 years?
It sounds a little shaky.
Sounds a little shaky in the middle of Cold War. They had a lot of shoddy science in Moscow. I think this is a myth. And I think people with asthma listen and hear just as well as people without asthma. Yeah. I think this is junk science, and the myth is based on junk science.
Yeah, 30 people.
30 people and 40 years
okay.
in Moscow. I mean, it's not as if it was Johns Hopkins University and the research was reproduced. Right. 1976, that's a long time ago.
If you hear of a myth you think Zorba could bust, send it to the show in an email to
Zorba, if you can hear it, Zorba at WPR.org.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. A listener now in Chicago, Illinois. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
We appreciate your call. How can we help?
First of all, I'm a pharmacist. I had a pharmacy for 40 years, and I just retired. I filled 1,160,690 prescriptions in 40 years.
But who's counting?
Not one mistake.
How do you know that? How do you know how many you filled?
You know, I did it the old-fashioned way. My father was a pharmacist. I had four brothers. All five of us are pharmacists.
Oh, wow.
And I just sold my store to pharmacy, and my wife and I, and the help of Stars and Stripes Forever, packaged everything up and donated it to the men and women in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Oh, how
nice is that?
Wonderful.
Yeah.
That's
how
my
wonderful.
Way of ending my career.
So how can we help you?
In any
you
case,
know?
What I'm asking you is that in 1989, I had severe pain on the right rear quadrant of my body. So I went to the emergency room, and they found that I had a kidney stone. And the following day, I passed the stone about 4 millimeters.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have an issue until this year. I had the same type of pain. I went to the emergency room. They said that I had a stone. Now, my question is I don't know what to go on for a diet, number one. And number two, why is this happening to me all of a sudden?
Okay,
is this my reward for retiring?
No, it's not. It is not. And by the way, thanks so much for the troops. I mean, it's wonderful that you donated those things. I just want to thank you. You know, that's a wonderful thing you and your wife did. 1 to 2% of the population gets kidney stones. You know, and some people get recurrent kidney stones, and we don't know why. It's not diet-related at all. We used to say, well, stop dairy products, and then we prove, well, that doesn't do anything. And, in fact, it's good to actually take dairy products. So we don't know why there's stone makers and people who don't make stones. A lot of stones will stay in the kidney and never move. They're just stones, and they just stay there, and they don't move, and they don't cause harm unless they cause a blockage in the kidney. And then there's usually pain. So if you see a stone, you don't necessarily do anything about it. It can just be up there as long as your kidney function tests are fine, and that's a blood test. And they can do an ultrasound at a CAT scan and also see if your kidney is swollen. Lithotripsy is a sound wave, breaks up the stones, makes them smaller so you can actually pass them. It's a non-invasive way of essentially getting a stone to pass, which is really a great, you know, it's been a great boon because not as many people need surgery. Small stones pass, big stones don't. So what advice do we give to people with recurrent stones? Stay hydrated. That means drink when you're thirsty and try not to get too thirsty. And some people say, well, don't get thirsty at all. Just keep on flushing your kidneys. Well, the kidneys are not like a flush toilet. We don't actually flush the kidneys, but you want to keep a flow going. And why did it happen to you? And why is it happening to you? Bad luck. bad luck. That's right. It's just chance. We don't know why. And as long as your stone is checked and it's not a uric acid stone, which is similar to a gouty type stone, because gout is caused by uric acid. Some people call them gouty stones, but they're not. As long as it's not that, calcium is 92%, 96% of the stone's high number. That you're doing the right stuff. Just stay hydrated, and these things just happen. Periodically, you may pass a stone. So good luck to you.
Okay.
Enjoy your retirement, and thanks for what you sent away. It's really nice that it was a wonderful, compassionate act.
We appreciate the call. He's done a million and some prescriptions.
Who? Yeah, right. It was his pharmacy.
Yeah.
You know, so he had, numerically,
it's
there
about
were
as many.
And never made a mistake.
About as many shows
never made
as
a mistake. 1,500,000 shows.
Before we get
Seems
out of here.
Seems like that some days.
Before we get out of here, Zorba, let's see if we can give some helpful hints to John from Washington, Missouri, as he prepares to go sauna shopping. John writes, "My wife and I are contemplating doing some remodeling and adding a sauna. I've had very positive experiences with saunas in Germany, Russia, and here at home. I recently have found some information and claims about infrared saunas. Please help me sort out the facts and fiction on infrared saunas and the general benefits, if any, of using any sauna."
Well, first of all, saunas are great. They're traditionally old. You know, they're an old tradition in many countries, and they're traditionally done obviously with wood and coal. Eventually, with wood, and now they're often done electrically. And I know, and I'm sure that when electrical saunas came in, people said, "Well, tell me what's the difference between an electrical sauna and a sauna where there's wood outside the sauna that brings the heat in there." If we look at infrared light, which are heating lamps, they basically heat up your body. So the infrared saunas are just using direct radiant heat to your body. And, there's always the possibility that because you have direct heat on the body from a lamp, there may be a burn possibility versus a traditional sauna, which is simply within the air. Mm-hmm. I would choose this by aesthetics, and I would not choose it by science because I think they all have the same health benefits. What are the benefits? You feel good. Do they get rid of the toxins in your body? I don't know if they get rid of the toxins in your body, but I know every time I go into a sauna and I get out of a hot sauna, which is often in the winter, I feel great because I'm out of that heat. It makes me feel good to be in the cold air. And a lot of people say it tones their body and makes them feel fresh. By all means, it's organic.
If you're sweating out a lifestyle question, let us help. Send your question to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Take care, Tom, and stay well.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
Don't forget you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, or Brad Kohlberg and Adam Friedrich, are the two cowboys bringing you this hour. Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich, and our theme music by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll join us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
National support for Zorba Pastor on Your Health comes from the AED Superstore, helping people save lives with Philips HeartStart automated external defibrillators for business, school, travel, and home. Available at AEDSuperstore.com. Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0919Z.
PRI, Public Radio International.